Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. It's nice to have you here and to see that there's still a little bit of ambition left in Washington on a August summer afternoon at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that you didn't all use this as an excuse to leave the office and head home early, but rather come for what we think will be a valuable discussion today. I'm Rick Barton. I'm the co-director with Karen Von Hippel of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project, and on behalf of John Hamry, our president, and Kurt Campbell, who runs the International Security Program, we're happy to welcome you here to what we think will be a really good discussion on an important subject. We'd like to give special thanks to the Compton Foundation of California for encouraging this idea and also really investing over $1 million, not with us, but in this field with a number of other organizations, just encouraging study, and also to the Carnegie Corporation of New York, which has been even more generous in making the advancement of work on the post-conflict field possible. The idea for this work really came from some continuing challenges that I think we have all seen. It's clear that the challenge of insecure communities remains one of the great threats to making progress in any kind of reconstruction. There's also a youth bulge in most of the countries that we work in, an insufficient response from host governments and the international community, and all of this comes together to really oftentimes overwhelm us. The first sort of critical provocation that I had in my own career was visiting Liberia on what was the 13th peace agreement that had been negotiated. And some people were hopeful about it, and we got out into the countryside and went to what had been the Tubmanburg area for a couple of days. And we ended up going out with Ambassador Dane Smith, who was then the coordinator for West Africa, at the State Department, and we met with about 50 young rebels. And we did a very quick and somewhat superficial demographic study of the group of rebels that we were meeting with, and with a highly unscientific approach, came to the conclusion that the average person in the room, which was not a particularly compelling group of people, there was a 17-year-old male with 1.5 dependents who had been in the bush for about 5 years, probably had a drug habit, and was carrying a gun, although we couldn't see if he had ammunition. So that was sort of the basic building block of the community, and we thought it's not going to be particularly easy to rebuild this place if that's sort of the raw material that we're looking at. And it was quite representative of other parts of the country that we then visited. This was reinforced a few years later on other visits to Liberia, and obviously we've seen many of the same critical ingredients in a number of post-conflict reconstruction countries. But I think that part of what we are trying to do, all of us who work in this field, is that we start with what is there and figure out how you can make more of it, and that's essentially what has provoked the study. We asked Steve Siegel when he was here as a researcher in our project to take on this challenge, and he's really done a terrific job of contacting people all over the world who are running projects, individualized projects, and getting to see visiting others here in this country, working with Morgan Courtney, who used to be in our office as well, as she went off to Rwanda to do some field research for us, and see what they can identify as opportunities. And Steve will walk us through, I think, some really good, fresh ideas and also just set up some of the background. Steve came to us after teaching in Turkey for a year. He's a graduate of Williams College. He then did work here for a year, and now he's at DAI. I understand he's brought his own group of colleagues here in the front row, and they'll keep him honest if we don't. But he's just back from Sudan and Kenya, and he's really done an excellent job of developing this report, which our publications office here has just come out with, and I hope that most of you have copies. If you want more, we will have – there are others on sale as well, but we did want to make sure everybody here today got a chance to get a copy of it. We look for about a 15-minute presentation and with 40 minutes for discussion, question and answers. And Steve, we're looking forward to hearing your comments.
Hey, Rick, thank you very much for having me here today. It's quite a pleasure to be back after 4 months after my departure. And I'm sort of happy that this is now seeing the light of day after a fair amount of work. And as always, I'm very grateful to be here at CSIS. It's sort of been an invaluable experience here, and I'm just very grateful for the intellects and the mentoring that's gone on here. As always, the PCR project has done incredible work. And when I was in Nairobi, I was speaking with somebody who had just recently changed jobs and changed email addresses subsequently. And when I was speaking to her about my time in CSIS, she said, "Oh, yeah, that reminds me. I need to re-register my email address for the PCR brief." So that was a little plug there if you guys haven't done it yourselves. When I was here at CSIS, I spent a fair amount of time thinking about the split between theory and practice, and I think everybody who works in a think tank does. And when I was over in Sudan, it was illustrated to me sort of superficially when I was having a discussion with a guy who was working for a Japanese auto company and procuring motorbikes, ATVs, and Land Cruisers to be sent to humanitarian workers, NGOs, and private contractors there in Sudan. And he said he'd remembered that he'd seen some cards from CSIS, and it happened to be those of Rebecca Linder and Karen von Hippel, the co-director of the PCR project and a former research associate. And he asked me if they had any need for motorbikes or Land Cruisers when they came back to Sudan. And thinking about the finances of research institutions, I was sort of imagining what it would look like if the Carnegie Corporation got a proposal with a budget and with a line item for motorbikes and how well that would fly. But just as CSIS isn't really looking to procure more motorbikes for their research, agencies aren't really out there looking to buy massive amounts of books from Amazon.com or print out hundreds and hundreds of reports and pour through them to look for suggestions that might prove helpful when they're out in the field. So that's what we're doing. We're trying to synthesize information about these programs and produce them to the public so they can be easily digested and inspire more thinking. There's already been so much work that's being done right now that's very good. If you take a look at the new World Bank report, the World Development Report for 2007, it's entitled "Development in the Next Generation," and I just want to read a quote from that because I think it's quite prescient to what we're doing here. Development thinking and practice over the past couple of decades has focused on younger children, but relatively less attention has been paid to the generation beyond primary school age. This generation is the leading edge of a large wave of young people. How these youth manage the transition to adulthood will have profound effects on their own welfare, as well as the well-being of the subsequent generation. That's from François Bourguignon, the senior VP and chief economist of the World Bank. Other institutions, Search for Common Ground, Save the Children, Christian Children's Fund, Right to Play, War Child, they're all doing incredible work in this field. And it's sort of our interest to promote the work that they're doing. We're essentially doing their PR. And the clients, the ones who are benefiting, are those who are in the communities and benefit from the successful replication and adaptation of a program. And there are also people doing fantastic work in security sector reform and rule of law and community-based policing. And this need not be thought of as a separate technical area, something that needs to be completely isolated from the work that's being done with youth. In fact, the more cross-sectoral work that can be done, the better. And the challenges are here, too. A lot of this work is considered to be soft. When there's reconstruction going on, this may not be the first thing that people think of. There's always an indeterminate amount of beneficiaries, and the outcomes are frequently uncertain, and they're not easy to calibrate, or calculate, I should say. But in the process of sort of putting back together a country again, you make your assessments for both long and short term, and there's a great need to continuously reinforce the view that youth and this sizable chunk of the developing world's population is the future of these countries. So briefly, again, who is the audience? It is the donors, certainly, part of the ongoing effort to increase the visibility and significance of youth. This is both for development institutions such as USAID and the Department for International Development in the UK, the World Bank, as well as the military. Money can come from the Multi-Donor Trust Fund as well as Commander's Emergency Response Program funding, SERP funding, that's being used by civil affairs officers on the ground. This is, we're not really sort of discriminating between anybody who's handing out money, and we're saying this is something that is valuable and should be considered. It's also targeting implementers, you know, the child protection people. This is, you know, there are lessons learned, and having exposure to new programs is always valuable. It's also directed at the program managers, the chiefs of party, and other people who are on the ground who are dealing with the direct content and strategy of the programs on the ground in the field. And we believe that this knowledge and these lessons learned are transferable. You know, kids are kids everywhere. And while that may be sort of a large and gross simplification, and context matters, for instance, you know, a youth security patrol that may function outside in a refugee camp near Kigali may not work in the neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods of Dili, East Timor. We're saying that these are things that can be adapted by the people who are working there themselves. And it's just our responsibility to provide this information and say that more can be done. So to get started, I divided this according to the chapters of the report itself. So just a brief introduction. The youth security and safety programs themselves, I've selected 3 out of the 10 that are in the report. Then I'll go through the core findings and principles, the strategic recommendations, and the specific action steps that can lead from those. So we started off with these initial factors, that post-conflict environments are typically and inherently insecure. International forces that are there are very expensive, very hard to sustain, and they're too few in numbers. There are not enough people to control what is going on outside of their grasp. An adequate security sector and security forces take so much time to build, and it often doesn't happen right away. And in the interim, so many ad hoc approaches are used to fill gaps, whether it's militias, strongmen, vigilante justice groups, area councils, gangs. Not all of them are bad, of course. Some of them work. Some of them function. But some of them don't. And we believe that local citizens can take a more active role in promoting a positive process, and that youth have to be seen as partners in this as well. 50% of the world's population is under 25, so says the UNFPA. And in Africa and South Asia in particular, children and youth make up about 60% of the population. And in the world in general, from a larger view, 85% of the world's youth live in developing countries. This is the largest youth bulge we've seen in recent years. And whether you believe that this will lead to massive amounts of instability in the developing world or not, it is certainly a force to be reckoned with. So we posit that youth can play a constructive role in building safer communities. This is the process of working with both youth and the community to increase safety. And it includes, first of all, reducing one potential driver of conflict, that is the youth themselves, by providing opportunities for those who might otherwise be engaged in violence and crime. There's an estimated 300,000 child soldiers who are currently involved in armed conflict. We're not really sure how accurate that figure is. It was provided in 2001 by the Coalition to Stop the Use of Child Soldiers, and it hasn't really been revised. So it could be larger, it could be smaller. It's hard to say. But that number also doesn't include the amount that are involved in gangs or smaller local militias. So it is certainly a factor to be dealt with. And number two, engaging youth in specific programs can help improve the safety of communities and contribute to its growth and reconstruction. Briefly, just defining youth. We chose to define youth, the ones that we would like to work with is between 15 to 20. This is the transitional phase between a childhood and adulthood, and it is the key group that is frequently targeted by violent groups. Program director for Christian Children's Fund said that it's the most overlooked and the least targeted group of individuals. And contextual definitions of youth are key. A youth in Rwanda may be considered, you know, a 32-year-old person may be considered youth, whereas somewhere in the northern parts of Kenya may be quite younger. Somebody who's 13 may be considered a full-fledged adult. In the current approaches to youth programming, youth are usually seen in sort of a Manichaean light as either victims or perpetrators. Rarely are they merged. Child protection, as sort of defined by the International Convention for Rights of the Child, is the initial and primary focus in post-conflict. It's, you know, how do we protect these kids who are here? And secondarily, there's education, job training, civic and political engagement programs that follow. But those are contingent upon security in these places, because those aren't going to come about unless the environment is workable. And youth can play a positive role in providing security as part of this spectrum of youth-related activities. this has been frequently the most overlooked part of it, and this is what we're trying to shed more light on. There are certainly challenges to these programs, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But what we're trying to say is that in the general spectrum of youth activities, this is something to pay attention to. The methodology, just for your interest, did interviews with about 35 practitioners and policymakers, and there was a desk research component. Approximately 130 books, reports, and working papers and articles were reviewed for this, and there were limited field research components. One former CSIS employee was working with UNHCR in Rwanda, and she provided a report on Rwandan youth in security situations that's included in the appendix to this. And Morgan, are you here? She's here as well, I think. There she is, right there. So if you want to ask her about Rwanda specifically, she will, I'm sure, be happy to answer questions. We also did some work with anti-gang programming here in Washington, D.C. to see what they were doing to mobilize youth and engage them here in our own city. So the programs themselves. We did 40 evaluations of different programs and picked 10 of them that we thought were provided sort of a broad range, interesting aspects to each of them. And a lot of them come out with similar outcomes. But we wanted to provide a variety of tactics that were used to get youth involved. It came from a variety of places as well, all over the world, from both urban and rural locations. The first one is in Swakopmund, Namibia, which is right on the coast and has recently become somewhat of a tourist location for people working and living in Africa. Here's just a nice picture of it for you. What was going on there is that the residents were complaining that there was inadequate local police response to crime, that the police were receiving phone calls, community residents were providing reports, and nothing was happening. So instead of complaining and not really doing anything about it, one of the local youth named Paulo Shupla decided that he was going to start a sort of small group of patrollers that would go to the beach at night and walk around just to provide visibility and safety for the people who were there. This happened during Christmas time, and after about 2 weeks of that, the mayor caught wind of this and decided to expand the mandate and create an actual organization. So this began to grow, and after that, they created about 4 to 5 different patrols that were on duty 24 hours a day, of 4 to 5 individuals who were in plain clothes and just walking around. They were unarmed, of course, and they were supported and endorsed by the community and the police themselves. The demographics, about 17 to 20 years old, and they were all male. And this later then got funding through USAID by the Namibia Institute for Democracy. And they provided more capacity building after this was done, so it became a self-sustaining organization that wouldn't need funding further down the road. And it has become largely success. It's gone all throughout Namibia. Youth Against Crime programs have been replicated throughout the country. And though Swakopmund's program is the most successful, they're gaining traction elsewhere as well. The outcomes. It filled a security gap, a critical one, and it improved the police responses to crime. They all had somebody who was doing something on the ground, and they felt compelled to join in as well. This proves that unarmed, self-organized patrols did have an effect on preventing crime, and it facilitated cohesion between the communities and the law enforcement officials as well. For the youths who were participating, it increased their civic engagement and boosted job opportunities after they were involved in this. The second program takes place in Revenga province in Venezuela, and it has a slightly different flavor, more of a private sector, corporate social responsibility. Lost my spot. This was established by the CEO of a rum company called CA Ron Santa Teresa. His name was Alberto Volmer. And what happened was one of his security guards was walking home from work one night and was attacked by a group of gang members and nearly beaten to death. The youths were then caught by the police and brought to Alberto Volmer, and they asked him what he wanted to do with them. In a place like Revenga province, this is, I guess, common practice. They weren't brought to court. And he said that instead of putting them in prison, he wanted them to work for him. And so what he did is he put them to work for 3 months, did not pay them anything, but said that after that they would be free to go. And so what happened here was that he began to create an actual program where youth who were involved in gangs could enlist themselves, essentially, to work for the company for free for 3 months. They would be given education, vocational training, as well as participation in sports. This is a photograph of the rugby team that plays games all throughout Venezuela. And they would be provided with housing and food. And at the end, they would be then free to either leave or to pursue more vocational training with the company in coffee growing, in architecture, and woodworking as well. There's a program in Albania called Weapons in Exchange for Development, where communities were asked to give up guns in exchange for money that would be then used to provide for roads and sanitation. And this is essentially prison time in exchange for hard labor and reform. It currently has about 130 participants and graduates, and they claim that about 40%, there has been approximately a 40% reduction in the area's crime, and several gangs have been completely disarmed. This also serves as a model for business involvement in youth safety programs and police reform as well, because this successfully was run completely by a private sector. He was also very successful in creating community councils in the area to get the local community involved in what they wanted to do and how they wanted to carry out the police reform in the future. The third one is from the United States itself. It's an AmeriCorps program that's run out of Clearwater, Florida. And this one is quite unique for AmeriCorps programs because most of them don't really directly deal with safety and security. It was developed in partnership with the Clearwater Area Police Department. And what they decided to do was bring about 10 to 12 kids, generally aged 18 to 22, on as force multipliers. They were visible extensions of the police, and they would walk around schools, safe sites as deemed by the Department of Homeland Security. They were given radios, bicycles. They would patrol parks and beaches. And they directed also a lot of outreach campaigns and volunteer campaigns to get the community involved in talking more with the police. This, again, facilitated more of dialogue between the two to allow youth to speak more directly to the police, to allow community residents to speak to the police, and to have a larger community involvement in their own security and safety. It also, like Proyecto Alcatraz, engaged private business with law enforcement officials and proved very beneficial to the participants themselves. It was there was a stipend of $10,000 a year, and many of them ended up getting jobs with the police department after they were done. Just a couple numbers here. The youth, only 10 to 12 of them, provided a 5% staff increase for the area police department. They saved almost $200,000 of the police's money in 1 year and provided about 5,000 hours of safety patrols. So, core findings and principles. We determined that the three essential components of success were the following: youth ownership, the community needs determine the solutions, and that you integrate the other needs of youth. We're saying, of course, that these youth and security and safety programs are essential and should be considered in this spectrum of activities. But the other elements, economic, vocational training, as well as protection, are also essential as well, particularly in post-conflict countries. The lessons learned that we primarily derive from here is that youth can organize and govern programs with limited adult contributions. Adults are very good at securing traction and mobilizing support within communities, but youth are largely capable of doing it themselves with, like I said, limited supervision, or limited direction, I should say. Community partnerships are key to successful youth programming. If you don't have community buy-in, it will be very difficult for a program to be sustainable. The programs need to be fully inclusive. In a number of post-conflict countries, criteria is defined such that there are specific youth groups that are targeted, whether it be child soldiers or orphans and vulnerable children. The problem is that this creates a fair amount of resentment, and not all of the youth are given access to the benefits that are coming in through the funding. So it's a concern that needs to be taken into consideration, that all youth who are affected by war need to be included in as possible participants in youth programming. Additionally, the program should respond to market demands. If you create vocational training programs, you need to make sure that the training programs will be sustainable due to what is demanded by the community. The challenges here, there are also challenges as well, of course. Street credibility and independence can make or break a program. If a program is thought to be too closely related to institutions that are not viable by youth, whether that's police or the government. They won't have any traction with the youth themselves, and there won't be buy-in. Programs in which youth publicly provide security may pose risks to the youth themselves. Of course, if they're participating in providing safety and security, there's heightened visibility, and there's always the potential for reprisals. So communities need to determine for themselves how much of a risk can be taken and what there is there within the context of that community as well. And thirdly, youth already engaged in violence pose challenges. Part of what we'd like to say is that this fringe group is one that needs to be targeted. If youth from 15 to 20 are already part of the fringe in terms of youth and child programming, youth that are engaged in violence are far along on the very far end of that fringe. The strategic recommendations. This is for policymakers as well as program officers and local community leaders who would be leading these programs. Mainstream youth into international and national policy. What we mean by this is providing opportunities for dialogue at national, regional, and municipal levels, and encourage wider discussion and government endorsement of innovative and successful programming. Youth Crime Watch Liberia is a program that has been running very effectively in that country, very much in part, largely due to the endorsement that is received from the government. Part of this is developing partnerships with relevant agencies such as security forces or ministries of youth, culture, and sports, as well as forging additional partnerships with international peacekeepers like the UN or regional forces. Secondly, creating community safety councils. This fosters partnership and cooperation and open dialogue between community members and security personnel. It also recruits adults and youth from the community to begin discussing these issues and includes local leaders and business representatives as well as security personnel in these discussions. And it creates opportunities for youth to interact with the communities and other members of the communities that they wouldn't normally interact with on a daily basis. And it also provides opportunities for youth to take leadership roles. Thirdly, developing partnerships with the private sector. Partnerships with the private sector are great because they provide opportunities for in-kind gifts and direct funding, as well as employment opportunities and training for the youth. It also integrates them more closely with the communities and provides opportunity to get their interests in line with that of the rest of the community. Fourthly, working with local communities and religious institutions. In lots of these places, schools, mosques, and churches attract large portions of youth. And where religion plays a major role in communities, these institutions can be very helpful to mobilize and organize youth. Schools can be used for after-school activities and weekend activities, and unemployed teachers are a great resource and potential leaders for youth programming. And five, provide incentives for participation. This can be anything from very low cost and simple incentives like providing school fees and books or food and clothing to anything including new technologies that are becoming cheaper and cheaper every day, like radios, cell phones, laptop computers, and internet access. These things can draw youth into participation and provide incentives to get them to continue to participate. And the action steps themselves. There are just three of them, but I think they're a little bit complicated, so I hope you can bear with me. Number one is develop youth-managed community watch and early warning systems. This involves organizing youth patrols with appropriate monitoring and clear reporting structures, as well as enforcement capacity. Oftentimes, youth will not be doing the enforcement themselves, so you need to find out who will be and what potential there is. Developing partnerships with youth-organized programs and security forces, and then here, along with the incentives, there are ways to make this easier, using bicycles and radios to increase the efficacy and the coverage. This is also, there has been discussion of employing youth in appropriately sized groups to provide escort services for women collecting firewood and water and younger children going to school. That happened in the Philippines. This obviously is not something that would be used in areas where there's high risk, such as Darfur, but we're saying in places where it's not the threat of a militia, but rather just one person, one or two people, the general idea of protecting people in large groups. And also considering nationwide program options like National Youth Corps. Second is creating safety multiplier programs like AmeriCorps Clearwater. This is done by determining staffing gaps that youth can fill. What options are there? An assessment was recently done in northern Uganda to determine what options were there for community policing. In addition to uncovering a number of gaps based on the police themselves, there were also a number of administrative roles that could be staffed by youth. You can appoint a facilitator to help manage relationships between youth and security forces as well as the community, and establish low-risk zones where youth can patrol and monitor to free up time for the police or security forces in the area. There are also opportunities to implement first responder systems and train youth in fire safety, in health, in waterborne diseases, gender-based violence, human trafficking, crime reduction, so they can disseminate that information throughout the communities. 3, incorporate youth in security sector reform and rule of law programs. This is definitely more of a cerebral approach, but it's something that I think is quite important. This is engaging youth to determine gaps and critical weaknesses in developing security sector responses themselves. When security sector reform is taking place, youth are often overlooked. They're not part of the equation. This is something that needs to change. Also, involve trained youth in disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration programs for young ex-combatants, particularly those who will transition into the security sector. If there are youth who will be making the transition from a child soldier or a young soldier into a policeman or into a member of the armed forces, this is crucial. And there's also the possibility to consider youth for apprenticeships and mentoring programs. And finally, promote youth-sensitive training to mitigate the potential for adversarial relationships between youth and security forces. When I was in Sudan, I already noticed that there was a fair amount of bad blood between the youth in the area, as well as the police. The police kept themselves sequestered and isolated in camps and didn't interact with the rest of the population, especially the youth. So this is something that could be essential. So in conclusion, there is an enormous and growing youth population, and they're not being sufficiently engaged in the process of providing security and safety in post-conflict areas. And donors and implementers should consider youth safety and security programs as part of the spectrum of activities in which youth can participate. That's it.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks very much, Steve. I think that's a really good overview of the work, and certainly puts forward a few challenges to this audience. I know there are many of you who have been doing this kind of work, and so we look forward to your comments and questions. And we have about 25 minutes for that discussion, so please step forward.
Female ex-combatants, not as much, but there were certainly programs that did target female youth. There's one in South Africa that made sure that it was 50% male and female, and they were doing work in urban communities, resolving disputes and doing conflict mitigation exercises. As far as female ex-combatants, I know there's been a lot of work and research done on the role of female ex-combatants in Timor. In Sri Lanka, but I don't think anything has been done yet programmatically in that area on female ex-combatants.
Yes, sir.
You alluded to career training or skills training, I think, at some point for youth, creating a skilled population. You see more evidence of that being used as a strategy, teaching youth how to do things, how to get employment.
Absolutely. I think that just from what I've heard recently, there's a program that's being carried out in Liberia where youth are being employed by private contractors to provide basically construction labor. And the contractors are paid extra money to boost the employment and to basically provide vocational training to these youth and to engage them in this process. And what it does is it creates an artificial economy. There are not sufficient jobs for these youth, but in the process they do get trained and they are quite mobile, so they end up moving around the country and having this training that they've been provided with. So it's an opportunity to get them engaged in the short term to provide an actual, you know, a valuable product. They've created a building. They've created part of the community. And it's also given them the training that will allow them to participate in the future should that go on.
And I think we saw that as a more traditional approach, and that certainly that was the more familiar approach. And what we were really looking to do here is to try to take on sort of the insecurity issue, and really that gap has been the focus. So we wanted to see whether there was something in the vocational area that really had that good a fit, that tight a fit, because that hadn't been an explicit part of most of the existing programs. Let's go here.
Actually, I thought it was excellent.
Especially
at the end, where you had your action steps, I thought they were pretty innovative. But I haven't, you know, a lot of the other stuff I've seen elsewhere. But those were specific ideas that seemed new, and that's what I appreciated most. My main question is about this idea of having large groups of youth working as sort of quasi proxy police. That police presence, and especially in Latin America, where you have between youth gangs and the police these pretty strong rivalries in quite a lot of places, and you sort of alluded to the potential for reprisals. You know, I'd like you to kind of get into that a little bit more, and if you came across evidence that if you do sort of foment this new cadre of youth, like a new type of youth group, you've got youth gangs, got police gangs, if there's the potential to be, you know, there's definitely the potential for this mediating role, let's say, that kind of smooths things out. There's also, I would think, a huge potential for just creating a new type of youth gang that's kind of got a little bit more legitimacy, and which could be that much more sort of dangerous if they think that they're legitimate. And, I don't know, I mean, if you can.
Right. Oh, certainly. I mean, I think in terms of a slightly more legitimate gang that happened in Nigeria with the Bakassi boys, which is essentially that they were requested, sort of the community requested that there was justice or, you know, a group to provide security for the community since it wasn't being provided by the state. And it essentially turned into a vigilante justice group and then basically a gang that controlled itself and just another militia. So it was something that started out innocently enough, and then transitioned into something that became a much larger problem. In terms of mediating between the two, in Guatemala there has been, you know, there's an incredible amount of tension between the police and the gangs themselves, and it's largely irreconcilable. But there has been a lot of positive work that has been done in trying to get youth to speak to the police, to speak to the security forces that are there. There have been soccer games that have been introduced to get police to play against gangs, obviously in a disarmed setting, to get them to talk to each other. And a lot of it, I think, is dependent upon the charisma and the motivation of the people who are running these programs and their willingness to get involved and attempt or unorthodox methods of getting to these youth and getting them to consider other options. Also, from the other side, it's considering unorthodox methods from within the security forces themselves. So a lot of advances can be made, but if there is a resistant commander or somebody who's in the security forces who is unwilling to view youth as potential assets and only views them as perpetrators, not a lot of headway will be made. But at the same time, it's always worth the effort to try to get them to talk to each other. So you know, essentially to say that there is this potential that they that by providing venues for discussion and opportunities for getting these two groups together, especially in the context of one specific community and those community needs, you can provide opportunities for beneficial partnerships as well.
I think it's another reason that we emphasize the ownership by the community. So that these don't become totally independent groups, but it's something that the community has promoted and then has directly engaged the youth in the design as well as the implementation. So we recognize the risk of that, but again, the risk of the lawlessness and the insecurity really is greater. I think our definition is broad because the community starts with probably the nation, but then it breaks down oftentimes into townships and neighborhoods depending on the size of the city. So it's thinking of the national community and then finding very practical levels that it can be applied, because trying to do these things oftentimes at the national level, even though we say the ideas have to be mainstream, when you try to do them at the national level in the kinds of places that we work in, oftentimes you're at such a disadvantage. It's so hard to do anything that way that you have to get down to your implementing level, which is the local townships or a neighborhood within a city. Does that answer your question? Well, that's a great question. Obviously, not everybody has figured that out. But one way that we like to do it is by building successes. So if there's nothing like a success for other people to replicate it and to get additional funding and the kind of support that's needed. The problems are fairly common across the various communities. So that's the best way to do it, rather than announcing a national initiative, which then is likely to fail because it has too many moving parts in a society that isn't too good at making moving parts work together. So that would be probably the short answer. Why don't we go to the back, and then we'll go over here, and then we'll go over here, and just keep moving around. Yes.
I guess I'll start with your concerns about this and demilitarizing youth. I think that, you know, this is never necessarily an intention to arm youth, obviously, and that was considered as criteria from the get-go. But in a sense, I think that in some instances, the suggestions that we've offered there aren't applicable for specific contexts. And while there may not be a place for a safety patrol, a security patrol, a neighborhood watch program in these locations, there are other opportunities to begin to increase safety by bringing partnerships together, by getting people on the same page and getting them to talk. So if disarmament is the ultimate end goal in a lot of these places that you've mentioned, which it is, then the idea of getting youth to talk with the security sector, to get them involved in what they're doing as a way of bringing them closer to the community, I think, is something that we would say would be valuable. Insofar as quantifying the impact, this is sort of a perennial post-conflict development world issue, and not necessarily specific to this one in general. And I think largely there's lack of funding to provide good evaluations for these programs. And the assessments themselves are frequently done by those who are carrying them out. People provide reports on their own programs, and that proves difficult in that there aren't enough people to go around. There isn't enough money to go around to hire large amounts of evaluators to go visit these programs. At the same time, the hope is that eventually there will be the potential to sit down and begin to amalgamate some of these successes. and bring them into a more quantifiable picture. But at the moment, it hasn't really been done. This is sort of, we're looking at it as just the first step.
Yeah, I think.
You know, a couple of additional points. One of the things that I've seen working with a lot of demobilization reintegration programs, former fighters, is that oftentimes you want to work with that group, but you don't want them to be a favored group. And so how do you design something that addresses the challenge they present to society without elevating them into a higher status than the rest of society? And it's a very delicate balance. And I think that a lot of the suggestions in this report actually figure out how to address that challenge fairly well. Another thing that we thought of with youth is that they're not going to make the community safer, but in many of these places, all you can really do is give people an early warning, a slightly better warning. And that may not seem like much, but that's a considerable improvement over what people have right now, which is to become victims of attacks. So they have the opportunity to run one day earlier or 1 minute earlier. And that's something that we saw in Moffat County, because when I was working for UNHCR, we had to open and close our offices in Moffat County several times. And actually having that 10-minute warning was about all the advantage that the internationals had over the local people, which probably meant the difference between being kept alive and dying. Finally, one of the things we're trying to address with this entire subject is that people don't really like to spend money on security. And the international donors don't really, other than the rather obvious ways of sending in the military. And there's a huge gap between sending in the military and making a community safe. And so we're trying to figure out, okay, what are some things that you can do that are going to start to give people some measure of progress? Because what you're looking at in so many of these places is just making things a little bit better than they were yesterday and sort of building that hope. It's not really the transformation that some of us dream about or our rhetoric necessarily suggests. So we're working within a very kind of pragmatic sort of what we think sensible zone here. Yes, this... this woman right here in the middle, yes. Could you speak up just a bit, please?
When you visit Africa, do you go to the rural areas? The rural areas is where the community starts. And when the community starts in the rural area...
Thank you.
Thank you for that. It's a very valid point, and I think that you're very correct in saying that a lot of these problems can be taken care of from the areas, the smaller areas themselves. There is a lot of urban flight, and people do end up coming to the bigger areas from outside. And I think that a lot of these programs have, not a lot of them, I should say, but a number of these programs have actually sought to replicate themselves in the smaller areas, in the more remote areas of the countries that they're currently working in. And they've had a great deal of success in doing that, particularly just as one that's in the report, Youth Crime Watch Liberia, began as a program in an urban area and then began to move further out into the country. And once it had sort of established itself, it started going further out into the farther reaches of the country and has done quite well.
Yes.
You made brief mention of athletics and how Right to Play, for example, is an organization that's working in post-conflict zones. What are they doing exactly in order to translate life lessons that students learn on the
Right to Play combines, I mean, they don't do just, you know, after school sports, for instance. They do a lot of conflict mitigation, crisis mitigation work in trying to get youth involved in dispute resolution mechanisms and do education outreach with the community to get them directly involved with where they're working. So, largely I believe that, you know, Right to Play, it advertises itself as an organization that uses sports as a medium to reach kids. And I think that's what it is, that it does teach them how to play soccer and, you know, tennis and badminton and what have you. But in the end, what it's trying to do is provide a venue that can bring lots of kids together, that they can then provide civic, education and training to when they're there. And I think that's, for the most part, what I've seen in the work that they've done. Yes. Again, I'm coming back to Youth Crime Watch Liberia. They ended up using local schools as a way to attract the population, the people that they wanted to engage in their programs. So they ended up using the local teachers there to provide support for the programs, provide supervision, and also as a venue to mobilize kids. So when I say, you know, local schools as a venue, in a lot of areas, the schools may not be operational. They may not be functioning. And this is, again, something where, in conjunction with the development of education, rehabilitation, as well as trying to provide jobs for out-of-work teachers, this is something that can be done in conjunction with that. So if it is working on building educational capacity, this can be added on to that. I think the criteria actually was what provided the largest amount of difficulty for this project, since the programs were such they came from such a large variety of places and were so different in their programmatic aspects. It was very difficult to set clear lines that were very narrow. So we sort of cast a wider net, saying what did successfully engage youth, and B, successfully make citizens feel as if they were safer. And so I think that's the key. We're not saying that there were actual numbers. I'm sort of hesitant to endorse anyone that says that a youth program, you know, successfully dropped crime by 10% or reduced the amount of homicides by 20%, something like that, because I think that that data, is very hard to determine the causality. But in most of these cases, the comments that have come back from the community have perpetuated the programs themselves. So a lot of it is saying that the residents themselves do feel safer and do feel as if this program has benefited their community quite positively. There wasn't, you know, a clear question, I think, that could say this was a successful program as defined by A, B, and C, but just sort of looking at it from a holistic perspective, saying, is this something that engaged youth and did make the residents there feel happy about what was going on?
Yeah, I think it could be done. It's not a challenge that's beyond achievement. It's just so happened that within the scope that we worked on, we essentially were not looking for huge numbers. We just wanted to see if there were practices that could be transferable and used in other places. So that was part of what we were trying to identify. And we were asking people for their sense of the impact. One of the additional problems that will, when somebody does get into it in a formal way, is that it'll be hard to come up with any really good baseline crime numbers. So to determine what crime was like yesterday, you're going to have probably the first really good review of what crime is like today, and that will be your measure for in the kinds of communities that we work in, because the data is usually so unreliable. But it can be done. It just didn't happen to be really the emphasis of this. As you know, we have spent quite a lot of time on measuring progress as a concept, and we do think that it's one of the three chronic weaknesses in all of these cases, that people don't have a baseline. They don't really know what direction they're heading in. They don't really set a very clear goal. And therefore, movement does not necessarily equal progress. And as you know, those of us who've worked in the field, generally sometimes you can have an overall failure in a country, and you can have 100 successful programs that seem to be that have all reported good indicators. And so that has interested us in that subject, and we've obviously had other discussions about this, but thanks. Listen, I think we have time for about three or four more questions. Let me just see how many people still – okay, why don't we just take those of you who have your hands up now. We'll just get to all of you. I'm going to save you for last so you can talk about your Afghanistan initiative, if you don't mind. So you don't feel as if I'm forgetting you or avoiding you. Why don't we just go right from here and work our way around this side of the room, and we'll come back to our Afghan youth program as our last questioner. Yes.
The question of ownership, I think, is a very good one, particularly because you have two forces at work. You have the ownership of the problems of the community itself, sort of the larger factors, and then the internal structure of the program itself. And to a large degree, I think the ownership of when it comes from the youth needs to be looked at in terms of the structure, just the structure of the institution or the program that's involving the youth itself. And the ownership comes from a community-wide discussion, which, of course, includes youth, but isn't necessarily just youth specifically. So when you discuss community safety councils or municipal gatherings that are looking at the issues of community safety and security, that is local ownership insofar as it's getting everybody involved, the key stakeholders in addition to the fringe and the people who are generally not involved in those discussions, whether they're the security forces or the businesses. And then looking at the programmatic aspects from the perspective of the youth who are going to be doing it. Oftentimes, programs can be started by a charismatic adult who's willing to get involved and then can transfer the leadership into the youth very, very easily. In some instances, like in Swakopmund, they were started by the youth themselves, and then the structure was offered to them by giving them legitimacy. And as seen through the government. So it can come from both. It can be started organically from the youth, or it can be offered directly to them, and a great degree of control can be given to them while they're doing this, even with adult oversight.
This is, for me, a really important issue, because I think for all the programs that you can put on in the world, and there are obviously millions of them, the most effective ones are those that really are owned by the community. So what does that look like? And for me, there are a few key tests. Are the people that are running the program, are they capable of mobilizing anybody in their community? I don't care if they mobilize the whole community. Can they mobilize anybody? A second test, do they contribute resources? Or is it all externally supported? Because that's a sign of a commitment. A third test, is there transparent handling of the resources they have? Can people see what they're doing? So a dollar spent, everybody knows where it went. And a fourth one would be, is there open decision making? So is whatever group that's been created, are they actually involved in deciding what the group is going to do? So if you had those elements, you've got a pretty good ownership package. And it comes back to sort of a core belief that we have, that you have to be successful in these places, you have to enhance three basic freedoms: freedom of movement, freedom of speech, and freedom of assembly. And you can see that all of those do that, but then they also say, okay, to play in this game, you have to ante up. You have to get into the game. You can't just show up. And people always have time. They always have themselves. And we're not asking everybody to give 10 cents out of their pocket. So the ownership doesn't – it can come a lot of different ways, but we want to see some signal that the community cares about it. And for us, the reason we care so much about it is that that's the governance dimension of this, as opposed to sort of the social welfare dimension of it. And I think if you don't have that combination, you're unlikely to have something that's really going to succeed. So. I'd rather not talk about my family.
I'm trying to think, actually. I mean, a lot of the reason that these programs were selected was because they were written up, and they, you know, theoretically, they were the ones that had success and were sustainable. So I think that's actually something that I'm quite interested in, and I think would be worth pursuing further. But unfortunately, since it's not documented, and failures in particular are very hard to come by, especially when you're here in Washington and not actually out in the field, it becomes quite a challenge, I think. So unfortunately, I wish I could comment on that, but I can't.
If you'd like to recommend a funder, we'd be happy to. We think we can come up with hundreds of examples, as our suspicion. Yeah, you jump the queue. Well, we'll still. I think that's really consistent with the philosophy that we tried to develop in this paper. So I hope as you read the paper that you'll see it's more that it is reinforced in that, because that was something that we were trying to suggest as we got into this work. I think there are a couple more people here. This is Morgan Courtney, who did the work in Rwanda that we mentioned earlier. Great. I think there are a couple more people here, or the three more people left. If you could make your point and a question quickly, that'd be great. I think it's a huge test, and as you say, it's the post-conflict countries that we're working in are such a wide range. I mean, some have honest, the war has actually stopped. In some cases, there are peace agreements that stick. Those tend to be the minority cases, actually. So most of the cases, the conflict still has not been really defined, has not been ended. And so I think all we were trying to do is to say this is an issue. There's probably going to be a transition phase, and maybe some of these practices could be entertained as you look at some of these difficult places where we can't even get international troops to commit to them. For example, and the local government really doesn't travel much outside of the capital. Yay. I mean, so it's we recognize that, we know that reality quite well, but we're just trying to enrich the menu of ideas and approaches that people are using in these places. And that's, so just so you understand, this is an ambitious idea, but with a high degree of modesty, both.
My question, however, and let me return to that for a specific reason, which is my own research interest, and which I feel was not addressed in the risk sector, which is, what are the ramifications of involving youth in the security sector for state building, for the state? As we all know, in Weber's functional definition of the state, it is the entity with the legitimate, with monopoly over legitimate use of violence, a monopoly. It seems to me that at least in a couple of your examples, youth vigilante groups or security enforcement groups, this strike me as extreme legal mechanisms. And in most of these situations, where we look at, we are not only faced with the question of security, but also one of state building, which complicates the situation. It's a confounding issue. If it was only one we were dealing with, for example, for Florida and the United States, we don't have any qualms about that. In a place like Afghanistan, my country, you have to be careful to balance both of those against each other often.
Sure.
So what are the ramifications of a suggestion like this for state building enterprise itself? I mean, we're not operating in a vacuum.
I mean, I think that largely, most of these programs, if we're discussing getting them involved in the security sector reform itself, or something that's more established on a national level, that is where looking at this from the perspective of state building does need to be a larger conversation and a larger discussion. I think in some of the instances it will be, you know, what is available and what is the lowest amount of evil that you can do to protect the community. So in places where there is no state, where the state either does not extend or there is no state to actually provide for the citizens, or there's nothing there, there are opportunities to look for protection, to look for security, and you know, to say what is the best possibility, even if it's not what you would have ideally in a more secure world. When it comes to states that do have a wider reach across the country, then I think you are correct. This is something that needs to be looked at as how can this feed into a legitimate mechanism? How can this be part of a larger effort to reform the country and to reform its institutions? And I think that the part of it is to actually look at how can you get youth involved in the process of reform from you know, a national perspective. How can you get their voices incorporated? Because so often they are disregarded and they're not part of that dialogue.
I'd like to supplement that by the state building exercise. I think for an awful lot of people who come from sort of national governments, is to think in terms of national governments. And Afghanistan, it's going to be very hard to run Afghanistan from Kabul, even if it was George Washington and he had all the advantages. And you don't start with that. So your state building really starts with your opportunities. And there are opportunities all over Afghanistan. There are communities that work. There may be maybe a few provinces that are working. And then you have the national government as well. And so you really have to go where you have the best chance of succeeding, because it's a very steep climb. The whole country is a reconstruction challenge. compound that with not having professional police who don't get paid. It doesn't help to have sort of marginal police who aren't getting paid. I mean, if you had marginal police and they were getting paid, that would be considerably better. So you have to look for these kinds of force multipliers in a way. And we're looking at it as a youth issue. Obviously, there's been a huge youth expansion in Afghanistan that hasn't been captured really by anybody because there hasn't been a good census in the, there hasn't been a census in the country, never, not a good one. The last one was 1979, and that wasn't any good. So our suspicion is that there are probably 10 million more people in Afghanistan than anybody is talking about right now. Could be more than that, which then puts a lot of other facts that people are using to base their programming on in doubt as well. So these are all things that you have to keep in mind. So the complexity of the place is really brutal, but let's see if we can find something that we can build with. And this seems to be a population that has to be engaged, and you're not going to get them back into the classroom in many cases. Yeah, and there's a huge effort being made there, obviously on the military, but not on the police. The police side has been lagging, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
The face of the government to the people. Yeah.
And
legitimacy.
Yeah. Yeah. And this would be another. This is a really another. I mean, we're happy to have this discussion with you, and it's another big discussion. I don't have to be a particularly big fan of national police forces. I think it's a big mistake, and we have not been successful with them in almost every place we've tried them. But we could take that on. I'd be happy to have 15 of the 34 provinces in Afghanistan have decent police. That would be like that would be 15 more than we have right now. So that would be a big success. But then to take it on nationally, it's even a greater challenge. So anyway, it's a good discussion. Okay, yes, sir. We've saved this last moment of glory here.
architecture and also the Anderson Foundation, and said, we love peace. And I would like you to go to this website, hippusa.org, and please, first of all, communicate with members, connect us with people, that we can work for the larger picture, not that for the security of a city, but for the safety and security and peace.
Right, right.
And second,
you know what I'm going to ask is, just because I think our program really needs to end, if I would ask that people who have an interest come and talk to you at the end of the program. And thank you very much for this description. Okay.
Take this to a little bit more further level.
Yes.
Of the policy, as everyone was writing, I appreciate my sister's discussion. The kids in the rural community, unfortunately, nobody's reaching.
Right.
That's the area where the rest are Al-Qaeda, where they can hunt. So we got to develop a program that we can successfully do.
Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking Steve for this excellent presentation.